Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Otis Wallen. In the 1970s, he became active in the Auburn Dam fight with Protect American River Canyons and co-authored The American River, Insider's Guide to Recreation, Ecology, and Cultural History of the North, Middle, and South Forks. He ran for local election on an anti-dam platform and ended up spending over 20 years serving as elected director on Placer County Water Agency. After 40 years, the dam proposal effectively died when we won the battle at the California State Water Resources Control Board, taking back from the federal government the water rights to build the dam, which is always a great thing when we actually have a victory. He served as executive director of the Committee for Sustainable Agriculture in the 1980s, leading to the 1990 Organic Food Act. He has served as executive director of Public Officials for Water and Environmental Reform in California since 1992, which sponsored the California Water Policy Conference for over 20 years. Since 1998, he's been president of the American River Watershed Institute, project manager for the EPA-funded project that developed the Sierra Climate Change Watershed Yield Calculator, now project manager for the Save Bear River fight to stop Centennial Dam on the Bear River. So, first off, thank you for all your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Derek. It's a great opportunity.
So, probably a lot of people don't know where the Bear River is. So, can you talk about the Bear River and first describe generally its location and everything, and then after that can you talk about what it was like, especially pre-conquest?
Sure. The Bear River is one of the great Sierra rivers that flow down the slopes of the Sierra into the Central Valley and then out through the Carquinez Straits and under the Golden Gate Bridge through the Bay Area and into the Pacific Ocean. The Bear River is basically parallels the Interstate 80. It's right between Sacramento, California, and Reno, Nevada. So that really between Lake Tahoe and Sacramento, it's a relatively small watershed compared to the other great rivers. There's an interesting story there. The Yuba River is a very well known river also, and a million and a half years ago, the Yuba River actually stole the upper watershed from the Bear River. In what they call stream capture. This is one of those geologic events where it made the Yuba River much bigger and the Bear River much smaller. But the Bear River was what they call the natives, the Nishinan Maidu Indians, called it Tsim Swale, which translates to river sleeps. And it was a sleeping river because exactly that the Yuba River stole the watershed, took most of the water. So it's a much calmer river than most other rivers, although it's in a Grand Canyon because it was 8.5 years ago one of the great rivers. It's also in one of the most ideal areas on the planet. The biosystem is extremely productive. The salmon populations were enormous. The Native American populations were some of the most dense on the West Coast and actually in North America. There was just it's a very plentiful environment. It doesn't snow so much on the lower elevations, and the Native Americans could ride the elevations, moving from the valley floor all the way up to several thousand and 5,000 and 7,000 feet in the mountains. Following the spring blossoms and the harvest in the fall. So it's been a very, very productive, wonderful ecosystem, and the waters are just fabulous.
Before we talk more about this, my first degree was in mineral engineering physics. I went to the Colorado School of Mines, so I know geology some, but I don't know the stream capture thing. That's really interesting to me. Can you give like a paragraph on how one watershed steals another watershed?
Yeah, in between these rivers there are ridges, and the geologic layers of the Sierra tipped up from the ocean, and they're roughly at 45 degrees. And one of those layers was very hard, and the layer behind it was very soft. So between the glacial actions of the upper watershed and also the erosion from below, they call it head cutting, when the river is cutting into a softer layer, between the glaciers and the river head cutting, it actually cut a channel through the ridge between the two rivers. And the entire upper watershed of the Yuba River, of the Bear River, started to flow into the Yuba. So it's a really a dramatic event in geology. And it created the Bear River Canyon is one of the great canyons of the Sierra. But as I said, you know, most of the water has been diverted by a natural process into the Yuba. So it was a very gentle river to live next to. And the Native Americans found it very, very a pleasing place to live.
And so when you talk about it being rich, you talked about salmon, and I presume that because it's called the Bear River, there used to be a ton of grizzly bears there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And black I remember bear. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and black bear.
I remember reading something a couple years ago about I was reading something about pre-conquest California, and along a lot of rivers in Northern California, you would reasonably expect to see a grizzly bear about every 15 minutes, and that sort of fecundity always thrills me.
Oh, absolutely, and of course the bear were there because the salmon were there in huge numbers. Just the fall, winter, spring, and summer runs of salmon all year round. So it's a very rich environment.
So before we talk about the current dam proposal, I was doing some research on the Bear River, and one of the things I was reading is that it got pretty hammered through the gold rush. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. It was one of the roots of the emigrant trail. It's one of the hearts of the mining era. It had some of the richest gold deposits. That actually is what started the water diversions. Water was diverted from the upper watersheds and actually diverted from that original Bear watershed that turned into the Yuba. The Yuba River water was diverted into the Bear Valley and on downstream and used for hydraulic mining. The hydraulic mining put inconceivable amounts of material into the river. It's just impossible to imagine the aggressiveness that those guys hosed down the mountains in order to get the gold. The sluice boxes were like 10 feet wide, 10 feet tall, and a half a mile long. And they just squirted water into the mountains and washed the mountains into these big sluice boxes. And every other day, they would put a 90-pound canister of mercury into the top of that sluice box. And all of this material, they've calculated how much material that was. And out of the Bear and Yuba watershed, I did some conversions on that. And if you took a 5-yard dump truck and lined them up, it would circle the world 3 times. A line bumper to bumper of 5-yard dump trucks is how much material got washed down these rivers. So that scoured these rivers horribly. And when finally the farmers in the Valley of California, who were getting inundated by all of this silt from the mining in the mountains, that was one of the great lawsuits of, I think it was the 1870s, when they put an end to hydraulic mining. The water be used for culture. This is an area between maybe 1710 and 1815. All of those miners from France and Italy and fruit stocks sent over from the old country, and they vines. And that lasted until the great dam building era after World War I.
So I'm sorry, Skype is kind of crapping out. So the last I heard was about all of the last I heard was the agriculturalists in the valley filing lawsuits, and then after that it got all Skypey and all So can you repeat that, please?
Sure. And so the farmers in the valley who were getting inundated by all of this material being washed out of the mountains for gold, filed suit and won the suit in the 1870s, which put an end to hydraulic mining. So you had all of these miners, and you had all of this diverted water, and the miners went to work as farmers up here in the foothills, and they got rootstock from the old country, and their Italian and French and English and family back in Europe. And this became one of the great agricultural areas of California until just after World War I, when there was another big dam-building push, which started to provide irrigation water for the valleys in California, the Great Valley. And at that point, the agricultural economy up here collapsed. And it went into grazing cattle. So there was cattle and sheep grazing, which, you know, they would run the herds through the rivers. And it was the Bear River and all of the rivers in the Sierra have had a very rough time of it in the last 150 years. It's really a testament to the glory of nature, basically, and the inherent willingness to restore itself, that you can have as beautiful a place as you can find here and there remaining in the Bear River. And those are the sections that are in between the dam. Just thousands of dams were built throughout the Sierra. So what natural rivers are left in between the dams are very precious, and they're very rich, incredibly rich oak woodlands here, and then higher in the elevations, a little bit conifer and oak mixed woodlands.
So before we talk about the current dam proposal, and thank you for saying all that. This is really important stuff, I think. And before we get to the current dam proposal, can you talk about a bit more? I mean, it's extraordinary, like you just said, it's extraordinary that the salmon have survived at all, given all this silt, given all the dams. So can you talk a little bit more and a little bit specific about the remaining places that are, the wild places that are still surviving on the Bear River, and who lives there? I mean, you started to, but can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and so after all of this this history, we have these rivers of the Sierra. At the base of these rivers are usually very large dams, and the salmon even today just cluster up to the very bottoms of these dams. There's a series of small watersheds, western creeks, that have hundreds of salmon in them. The salmon are still ready to get over the top of these big dams. But the salmon runs are sadly no longer at the elevation where we are. There's a lot of trout, rainbow trout, brown trout, and other fish in the fisheries. But really, I live right on the edge of the Bear River, and seeing black bear come down to the river, seeing deer, of course, and mountain lion, a bobcat. Fox in incredible numbers anymore, or coyote, very common on a daily basis, and the nighttime is filled with the sounds of coyotes and cats in the mountains, along with the dogs that live with people's houses. So many people are now really living in these areas. It's a retirement area, and has become, in the last 30 years, the grazing and all of the agriculture has basically collapsed. And it's these are rural estates. You know, now you're seeing 10, 20, 30, 40-acre parcels with million-dollar homes and white vinyl fences and recreational horses. So it's still a pretty rich environment. Problems, but nonetheless, the last stretches, the stretch of river here is also Indian, the Combi River down there, and Ron, the Bear, actually one of the most industrialized rivers in the Sierra. It's along the Interstate 80 corridor. The Trans-America Railroad was on this same ridge, the Emigrant Trail or before that. So this is the ridge in the Sierra that has had the most impact from people. And the Bear River has, from air source in the Sierra, it's a series of dams down to Rawlins, and then there's this stretch of 10 or 12 miles of absolutely gorgeous river. There's California Fish and Wildlife owns land there, Bureau of Land Management. There's a fabulous campground, and it's used all year round. It's one of the most accessible in the state. As a matter of fact, when Arnold Schwarzenegger, as governor, signed the Sierra Conservancy Bill into law, they jumped in their SUVs and drove up to the Bear River Campground to stage the signing of the bill, which celebrated the preservation of thousands of acres of Sierra prime habitat. And now we have that very spot is being threatened with a new dam proposal. It's actually an old dam proposal. It's kind of a zombie dam. We'll go into that a little bit, but this very same spot that Schwarzenegger signed the Sierra Conservancy Bill would be inundated by 150 feet of water. So this dam building era is not over yet.
That reminds me of David Brower's famous line about all of our victories are temporary and our losses are permanent.
Yeah, you have to fight it on a daily basis. If you lose on one day, you've lost the resource forever. So these battles are difficult, and they take a toll on folks. I've spent my whole adult life in dam fights. This is the third one, and we won the last two. One took half a century, but. I think that we will prevail on this one too. This particular dam was first proposed in 1926. That's why I call it a zombie. These kinds of proposals never quite die. They just go back into the grave and they wait for some federal or state bag of money to be jangled about. And then they come out of the grave and stand in line and see if they can't get some money. That's what happened here in California with Proposition 1.
So take us through the history of this particular dam. Start in 1920 and then jump us up through the present.
Yeah, 1926 was the first time this dam was proposed. And it was proposed with a series of dams that were all through the Sierra. And the purpose of these dams, they were called debris dams. And the purpose of the dams was to stop all of the hydraulic mining debris from the mining era of 40 years earlier in the 1800s, to stop that debris from going into the valley. So that was the first purpose for which this dam was proposed. It happened because the state of California came up with a bag of money. And they said, we will help you build a local dam. And that allowed local irrigation districts and local public entities to build these dams. It didn't get chosen. Just to the north on the Yuba River, Engelbright Dam was built in order to be one of those debris dams. One watershed to the south on the American River. Clementine was another dam that was built for the purpose of holding back debris, but this dam didn't get chosen. It was again considered in the great dam building era of the 1950s and early 60s. It was looked at again, and the Rawlins Reservoir, which is upstream of this site, got chosen over this dam, which they're now calling the Centennial Dam. And then we see these dams fall asleep, and this proposal was not written into the planning documents of the Nevada Irrigation District for over 30, 40 years. It was just missing. There was no mention of it. And a few years ago, California passed Proposition 1, which was called a drought bill. And just to get a little insight, you know, they say that legend is slave. Oh, it's made hostage. So the detail on this one was.
I think this is really crucial, and Skype is crapping out again. The last thing I heard was California passed Proposition 1.
Good. So California passed Proposition 1. This was ostensibly a drought bill, and it was aimed at trying to get water conveyed to Southern California across the Delta in Northern California. That's so that they could get a cleaner water supply and a more reliable supply. Now, Southern California are all Democrats, but they couldn't get the bill into in front of the people as an initiative unless they got some collaboration from the Republican side. And what happened there was the Republican side said, we need to have more dams. So in order to get your $9 billion to supply Southern California Democrats with water, you're going to have to put in $2.4 billion so that the Northern California Republicans can build some more dams. It's really as kind of bald-faced as that. So that was the compromise. The initiative went on the ballot. The people of California is stuck in 5 years of drought, voted for it. And now we have this big bag of money for building dams. And lo and behold, a week after this initiative was announced, Nevada Irrigation District pulled this new proposal, which is the old 1926 proposal, out of the rabbit out of the hat. And the zombie came back from the grave, and here we are dealing with it again.
And what's the rationale now? And the rationale for this dam?
The rationale now is really unbelievable. They say this is the climate change dam. This dam will protect us from the droughts caused by global warming. So they're claiming that this is the environmental dam. It is really an absurdity if you get into the actual effects of climate change. You find that the characteristic that is most, the salient characteristic is uncertainty and risk. And it is what they're projecting a certain series of weather patterns, and they are projecting a certain amount of water will be produced by this. I mean, basically they're saying the snowpack will not be there. The snowpack will fall as rain rather than as snow and will no longer serve as a reservoir for California. What you have to do is build more buckets to catch the rain. And the problem with that, of course, is that climate change is very unpredictable. And predicting that you're going to have the same amount of precipitation in the future as you've had in the past is simply a flawed approach. And there's a lot of complications with climate change that have not been part of the discussion in the past. Some of these are the way the natural ecosystem reacts to climate change. One of the things that happens is in these upper elevations, when they're no longer covered with snow, the trees no longer are dormant. And when they don't sleep, they transpire and they grow. So the growing rates of a forest goes from like 2% per year back up to about 6% per year, which is what it is at the lower elevations. And that actually reduces the runoff by about 20%. So you have factors like that that are starting to come in. They're studying snow sublimation.
Which, by the way, I've seen proposals by the state and by the timber industry that what that means is you need to clear cut those hillsides. To which a forest activist friend of mine said, why don't they just cover the hillsides with Bisqueen and get be done with it?
Yeah. Well, those are some of the early projections. Right now, the University of California, the Department of Forestry at Berkeley, University of California in Merced, they're actually coming up with a very sophisticated approach to what needs to happen in order to, first off, preserve the forests from fire. You have this multiple series of, it's a multiple hindrance attack for a forest. They've been managed for without fire. It's a fire ecosystem, and the natural fire return in the forest in the Sierra is about every 5 or 15 years. That basically naturally allowed. But fires have been did for the last 100 to 125 years. You have the early box forests, and you've got to do something with them. On the other side, global warming and climate change, these forests are no longer going through a dormant period, but they're going to be growing 12 months a year. And so that's just a ferocious amount of growth in an unbalanced forest. And actually, Berkeley and the Merced they've realized that you have to intervene on these forests. If you don't intervene, they're going to burn down in a catastrophic fire. We're seeing that every year. These 100,000 acre fires are destroying the entire forest. They're pyrolyzing the soils, making it as if you've covered the mountains with Bisqueen. And what they're now suggesting is you need to manage towards old growth. You need to manage down towards 40 to 60 trees per acre, which is about what you see in natural old growth. And today we have anywhere from 600 to 1,000 trees per acre. So it's a factor of 50 times in some places the number of trees that would normally be in the natural forest. So what we've done to the entire ecosystem and the forest ecosystem and the river systems of the Sierra over the last 150 years is an unimaginable change. And it has not been for the better. If let be, it'll be a catastrophic disaster. And there's almost no choice but to take some active approach. And I hope it is a wise one. You know, we really need to look at the scope and the scale of disaster we're facing. My guess is that if we really take a thorough view, the ideas of building $300 or $400 or $500 million dams will just be seen as too risky and foolish. I mean, what you really need to do is begin to actively repair and restore the forests to a more natural condition. And to an adaptive condition that can actually deal with the kind of increased threat from heat and fire we're going to have in the future. It's a tall order, but there are really a lot of good minds that are working on these kinds of approaches to restoring the Sierra.
So, and I don't see where putting in additional dams on an already harmed river helps in that. Can you talk about the specifics of the current proposal? How big is the proposed dam? How much will it inundate? What will be some of the costs associated with it? Yeah. Which I don't just mean economic costs, of course.
Yes. I mean, this would be the stretch of river in between these two reservoirs that I mentioned earlier, Combi and Rollins. It's about a 11-mile stretch of river, and 8 miles of which would be inundated, a 255-foot high dam. It would retain about 225,000 acre feet of water, about 115,000 of which they could manage on a yearly basis. Now that's a steep canyon in that area, so when they draw down 110,000 acre feet of water, the water level in that dam would fluctuate about 130 feet per year, which is hard to wrap your mind around what that looks like. If you've seen some of the pictures of California reservoirs that are in drought, well, that's what this local project would look like on a yearly basis, even if precipitation were normal. Since it's one of the last natural stretches of river in the whole stretch of the Bear, there's a series of dams above us. It's one of the last migration corridors for megafauna, for all kinds of birds and insects and plants. I mean, basically, these dams are a barrier for movement of life, and they transform the area around them as well. So these last corridors that can be used by the natural world are even more precious now that so many dams have been built and the habitat has already been destroyed. So we have a resource here that even it is close to Interstate 80 to people. A lot of fishers actually bring who want to learn how to float. They bring them here because it's so close, and they can they do catch and release in order to teach people how to fly fish. These areas are just enormously precious, and even more precious because of how scarce they are.
So we have about 16 or 17 minutes left, and before we talk about how people can help to try to stop this dam, I want to step back away from talking about the Bear River for a moment and ask what you have learned in the past lifetime of fighting dams, what you have learned that a lot of activists listen to this program, and what can people in other states, what advice as an elder dam fighter do you have for younger dam fighters around the world? What works, what doesn't work, how do you do it?
Yeah. For myself, I early started to practice meditation, and now have moved into Qigong, which is a Chinese energy movement meditation, and essentially doing meditation and doing Qigong in the wilderness has been what has sustained my ability to put really so much of my adult life's energies into these political fights. It's very, very easy to burn out when you're doing these kinds of battles. There's a lot of stress, there's a lot of tension, a lot of the interactions with your neighbors and with your friends and your community are antagonistic and very difficult. So I would have to say that a personal practice that allows you to practice patience, allows you to practice generosity, and allows you to practice awareness is really critical. And part of this is not laying blame, but actually being more compassionate towards the dam proponents. In many ways, they're stuck in a cultural paradigm of ignorance. They literally don't know better. Really coming at this from a place of how do we uplift the conversation? How do we uplift people's connection to the natural world and really to one another? Because the rivers are the lifeblood, the veins of the life of the Sierra. Just as our own veins carry blood in our own bodies, these carry the energy and the life for the system that we live in here. And we need to really take care. We had a couple of celebrations on the river, and a lot of the local Native Americans came, and they are still doing their original ceremonies at this stretch of the Bear River. One of the tribal leaders, this guy named Richard Johnson, we interviewed him, and he said something that was incredibly dramatic, and that was that his tribe had been reduced to 18 people from the thousands and thousands that lived here before 1848. And he said the violence that is expressed by building a dam on this living river is the same violence that led people to kill off his entire tribe. It's the same violence that created the genocide of the Anishinaabe tribe. And that struck me, I think, more deeply. You know, I'm 68 years old now, and that struck me as deeply as anything that I had, you know, really felt environmentally. I had not put that connection together. So when someone, when they do not understand the depth of the violence that that the proposal actually represents, you know, the violence that kills the ecosystem, the violence that wiped out the native tribes, wiped out the salmon. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, will lead you to a dark night of the soul. And if you don't have a personal practice, you know, to bring current awareness who you are, it's important to you. The stress of these kinds of battles. But it's really a daily struggle, and you know, practicing and being together with your fellow sojourners and comrades in environmental work. That's what can sustain you over time.
And you know, a few years ago, I've been fighting dams also for most of my adult life, and a few years ago I was getting kind of excited because I thought that there wasn't really the money for big dams anymore, and I thought that the era of big dam building was over. But there are huge dams going in on the Mekong, huge dams going in the Amazon basin, and I have a friend who fights dams up in Washington State who said there are some major proposals up there. And so I guess I love what you said about the dams being that level of violence. And you also said something about raising the conversation. How can we raise the conversation to understand, so people will understand exactly what you just said about dams being this level of violence against the earth, against the people who live there. And there's a current proposal in India for, gosh, I think it's either 3,000 or 30,000 new dams to basically kill all the rivers in India. It's really extraordinary, and I would have thought, sorry for going on about this, but I would have thought that at this stage, having seen all the damage that dams do, I'm kind of stunned that we still have to have this conversation, given what dams have done to the Columbia, the Colorado, what they've done to the Aral Sea, what they've done to the Rio Grande, what they've done to all these rivers. It's extraordinary to me that we have to have this conversation still. And I don't know if you have any response to that or not.
Oh, I do. You know, our human culture is so out of balance. You know, this is locally we have this dam being characterized, this zombie dam being characterized as a new wave of climate change dam, this environmental dam.
Which, by the way, one thing real quick is that so far as climate change, dams are counted often as carbon neutral, but they're actually, they've been also described by people who know better, who know these, understand these issues better, as, quote, methane bombs. They actually produce, when they're for electricity, which this one sounds like it's not, but when they are for electricity, it actually is higher carbon emissions per unit of energy than burning oil. They're dreadful, dreadful. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, they're absolutely dreadful, and you're absolutely right on the mark. It's like looking at an automobile. If you don't look at the full cycle of manufacturing, you know, how many millions of cubic yards of concrete, very high energy intensive material, go into the construction of these things, the transportation involved. It's really horrendous. What we're doing here locally is, and again, because we're in one of the most highly populated areas of the Sierra, and people have been here for quite a while now, I think our approach is being more sophisticated than we used to. We used to look at these things. We're no longer just saying no dams because they're wrong. I mean, basically, what we're looking at is an entire range of possible solutions to the problem. You know, for example, the hydroelectric side of it. If you look at the difference in solar and in wind, the price of those technologies and resources have been going down about 10% a year for the last 30 years. That's a trend that's going to continue. Whereas these larger scale hydroelectric plants, no matter of what kind, are really a thing of the past. Distributed energy is going to be the answer. So what will we have in this kind of zombie project? We have a project in search of a purpose. And what we have to do is be very sophisticated and very smart and say, what is the purpose? What is the fundamental interest in building this dam? What is it about, you know, more water doesn't necessarily bring you any happiness. If the amount of water you have, if you can deliver the same level of quality of life, that's what we're bringing. You know, with electricity. So what we, as we look at the higher range of possible solutions, if we look at better master or increase by in the high sea, that you'd be using in the groundwater basins in the valley to augment and make the water supplies more secure, rather than holding them on surface dams, use the subsurface groundwater and balance this with conjunctive use. Conservation, the local irrigation districts and water agencies have done very little with conservation. They have some of the highest per capita water use in the state of California. They have a lot of existing dams. We've challenged them to study the existing dams and try to optimize them. Some of these dams, and actually some of the proposals that are happening locally are raising some of the spillways 5 feet, maybe 10 feet, just incrementally optimizing existing facilities rather than trying to build a new one. If that goes, that's the supply side alternatives, the demand side alternatives, full ranges of conservation, both on the energy and on the water side. So what we're doing is we're doing very sophisticated problem analysis and saying, what problem are you solving with this $300 to $500 million proposal? How could you better solve that problem with a suite of both supply side and demand side alternatives that can provide the quality of life, which is the goal of power and water generation, without having to build these klutzy, huge, highly destructive facilities. And I think that we're actually going to prevail. Although, you know, this is such an unbalanced culture. Somebody like the Koch brothers, if they got pissed off at us locally, they could build this thing $300 million out of pocket and do it out of spite. So you just have to be very very vigilant, and really smart. You bring as much intelligence, as much analysis, and challenge them on every single basis. An example is the climate change dam. What I'm suggesting is they need to do a full range of analysis for all of the levels of variability, not just using the hydrology of the past. They have to look at this thing and really assess what happens if it rains less. And that's actually the prediction of more than half of the climate scenarios. If they build a big facility and there's not enough water to fill it, it's simply a waste of public monies. So we're trying to confront it on that level as well. So it goes to the level of heart, which is that's the first piece. When your heart is in the right place and you understand this, then basically you have to bring your mind to bear to be as clever and as intelligent as you can to resist these things. It's a long haul. You got to be into it for the long term. That first dam fight on Auburn Dam, 50 years.
So how can people who listen to this help? I know that there's a website called www.savebearriver.com. So they can get information there. What else can people do, both if they're A, local, and if they're B, not local?
That's the primary information source, and we will be keeping that updated. We are in the process of redoing the entire website. We have in the next 2 years, there's a host of processes. There's the California Environmental Quality Act studies that need to be done for a draft environmental impact report. There's the federal NEPA that needs to be done for a draft environmental impact statement. There's the California Water Commission and the analysis that they do to see if this is a project that's worth investing in. There's the water rights hearings at the State Water Resources Control Board. There's the licensing of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Each of these licensing and permitting processes has a distinct strategy. And those will be laid out when and where people can be effective as far as a public voice. And where they can be effective as far as donations and money. But significant legal battles that we're going to be fighting over the next couple of years. Really, we're saying a good for the opponent to that irrigation district. And we will watch.
I'm sorry, once again, Skype crapped out for about the last 30 seconds.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'm sorry, Skype crapped out again for about the last 30 seconds. Can you say your last 30 seconds again?
Sure, let's see. I've got a phone ringing here. Let me let that finish ringing. And then, let's see.
I heard NEPA, and I heard that there are going to be multiple battles fought over the next several years, and then it was all garbled.
Uh huh. Yeah. Okay. So over the next few years, we've got the California Environmental Quality Act draft environmental impact report. We've got the National Environmental Policy Act, the NEPA draft environmental impact study. You've got the FERC licensing process to license the hydroelectric component of the dam. You've got an Army Corps permit for environmental purposes. You've got analyses that will have to be done by Fish and Wildlife. You've got impacts that will have to be analyzed on the Bay Delta, and the California Water Commission will be a forum for that. You have water rights proceedings from the State Water Resources Control Board. Each and every one of these have a separate strategy, a separate battle, a separate legal maneuver, separate comment periods for public input. So it's a very complex array processes that that you go through, and you have to fight with diligence on each and every one of them. Essentially, we're trying to create a gauntlet for the Nevada Irrigation District, where we will win by 1,000 small cuts.
Well, and this sounds like it would also be just a tremendous opportunity, since there are so many battles to be fought there, a tremendous opportunity for young activists to really, you know, learn the ropes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The because it's right in between a couple of, you've got South Yuba River Citizens League up in the Nevada City area. You've got Protect American River Canyons. You've got the American River Watershed Institute. They're just a host of environmental groups that are grounded locally here. And volunteering and being watchful and joining all of those will keep you abreast of these. We've created a coalition of 30 different organizations called the Foothills Water Network, which likewise has a website, and those that coalition has been very, very strong in the last 10 years, focusing the efforts of all of these organizations into a very focused approach, both legally and strategically. So it's a wonderful time for people to get involved.
Well, thank you for all that, and I think this is really helpful, and I would like to thank you for all your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Otis Wallen. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. So you were great. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, great, Derek. I'm really glad that this worked out for you.
Oh, yeah, everything was great except the stupid Skype.
Yeah, hopefully that can be edited out. It's, you know, in some skillful way. So,
well, we'll see. Or at very worst, it'll still be fine. So this will probably play in 6 or 7 or 8 weeks, and I will let you know about a week before it's going to be up. I'll let you know so you can publicize it and let people know how to listen.
That's great. I thank you very much, Derek.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye.